97.9 FM, WCHL, and the UNC College of Journalism and Mass Communication presents Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus is dedicated to in-depth examinations of issues of overarching importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions to problems in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the UNC campus, here's your host, journalism professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, college athletes forming unions. Our guest, Dr. Richard Southall, a professor of sports entertainment management at the University of South Carolina and director of the College Sport Research Institute. And Jeff Hirsch, a professor at the UNC School of Law who specializes in labor law and union organizing. Gentlemen, this week for the first time ever, student athletes are asking to be represented by a labor union. The paperwork's actually been filed. National Labor Relations Board will look at that, and they're going to be represented by the National College Players Association, a group that says it's trying to improve playing conditions under the auspices of the NC2A. Richard, we'll start with you. When I first hear this idea, players unionizing, half of me says, good idea. The other half says, oh my gosh, that's awful. Which side of me is correct?
Well, it depends on what you mean by awful. If by awful you mean that it may fundamentally change college sport as we know it, yes. But I don't think what's interesting about this is that it's not been historically given much context. You know, the first college sport protest that we probably know about occurred in 1936 when Howard football players refused to take the field. And in LSU, a couple of players were dismissed. University of Pittsburgh players wanted to get paid for their participation in the Rose Bowl in 1937. And they held out until they got some more money for it. Over at Wake Forest University, in the first Gator Bowl, 1945, the Wake Forest players were offered $100 incentives by the boosters because players didn't want to go. They're like, why do we want to? We don't want to go to a bowl game. We want to go home. So this notion of player compensation, unionization, activism really was well, you know, documented before the NCAA changed four-year scholarships to one-year grant and aids. And so part of the reason for that was to keep the players in line. So historically, while this may never have occurred officially, you know, in the context that we're talking about, player protests and wanting to organize have a long history.
And Jeff, the NC2A offered what at least one writer referred to as a scornful response, saying that these student athletes cannot be considered employees. The move undermines the educational purpose of college athletics. Can players unionize?
Good question. I think under the current law, the odds of them getting legal approval for a formal union are long, quite long. Under the current case law of the National Labor Relations Board, which covers all private sector employers, including Northwestern in this case, they would pretty clearly say that these players are not employees. There's been a recent case where graduate assistants, research assistants, and teaching assistants tried to unionize, and the board, a Republican-led board, said they, in fact, were not employees. Now, there's been a lot of flip-flopping on that, the graduate student issue, and I think there's at least a plausible chance that under the current Democratic-led board, certainly on the graduate assistant issue, you might get a flip. The football players are a little bit different for reasons that we can talk about. But even if they got through the NLRB, you're going to have to get approval from either the federal appellate courts and then ultimately the Supreme Court. And there, I would not stake much money that the judges or justices on the court would actually approve of this.
Richard, another writer noted that this particular effort is, in his words, likely to fail, but the impact could still be far-reaching. And he talks about powerful winds of change.
Well, and I think that's what is most interesting about this, is that you have a group of players that, whether it's wearing a wristband or whether it is going to the NLRB, players are starting to take very tentative steps towards them being involved in this, instead of it being sort of as if the children are at the other table at Thanksgiving and the adults are over here talking about these things. And I applaud the coach, football coach at Northwestern, for saying this is what we want our young men to do. And so I do think this is just another indication that the status quo is no longer going to be what is moving forward. I agree totally with Jeff that this is much more of a news event than an actual change in the law, but I do think it is still significant that players are doing this and doing it in a very thoughtful, coherent, cogent fashion.
Jeff Richard had put some historical spin on this, but in recent history, we had the All Players United wristbands that the players wore. Grambling University players said, we're not going to go play this game unless you give us better conditions, et cetera. So players have banded together in some ways, but your general take on what their success level might be, if not through the NLRB in other ways.
Yeah, no, I think, and I agree with Richard's point that even if they don't succeed as a legal matter in defining themselves as an employee and getting formal recognition of a union, the fact remains that collective action, even if not necessarily legally approved, can have an impact. And it's hard to imagine a more stark example of the sort of blurred lines that at least athletes in the more revenue-producing sports face, the fact that there's even an arguable claim that they're an employee.
And we'll pick up on that thought right after this.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now, back to the show on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. Today we're talking about college athletes forming unions. Our guests, Dr. Richard Southall and Dr. Jeffrey Hirsch, here from the UNC School of Law. Richard, right before the break, we were talking about this definition, which the NC2A came up with several years ago, student athlete. And I think, and here's my bias coming through, that the NC2A and college and university administrators kind of hide behind that phrase, student athlete. Are they, the players in the revenue sports, are they really student athletes, or are they athletes who maybe on occasion go to class?
Well, I don't know that the distinction needs to be that severe going in one direction or the other. But anytime you have a hybrid word that you create, I think you have to go to the reason for its creation. And then secondly, it still doesn't change the status of the individual when they're engaged in labor. So when they're doing something in the classroom, that is a different and distinct situation from when they are generating revenue through their athletic labor. And I think what the term student athlete has done is sort of blinded the public to the fact that not all college athletes are the same. You know, about a year ago, I coined the phrase profit athlete and loss athlete, those two terms. Profit athletes are ones that have a greater market value than their grant and aid. Loss athletes are ones that it's a really good deal for them because the grant and aid that they receive is much greater than the market value of their athletic labor. So you have all of these sports that predominantly are upper class or middle class, white students, white athletes, and then you have a labor force that's generating the revenue to support all of these. So that's the first thing. And then I knew we'd probably be talking about pay today, and so I, of course, I live within the NCAA manual, and there the definition.
I feel for you.
Yeah, really. The definition of pay in bylaw 12.02.3 is pay is receipt of funds, awards, or benefits not permitted by the governing legislation of the association. So when Mark Emmert says we will not pay these athletes, he's actually linguistically correct, because if they approve any additional compensation, it no longer is pay. So this whole notion of athletes as employees really, in our minds, we have bought into this notion that they're student athletes, they can't get paid, when in fact they are paid. They are compensated. It's just a hard cap on the compensation. And that, to me, you know, it's sort of, if you give up on one thing in the NCAA, then is there, you know, the proverbial domino effect? And I think that's what's really interesting. Donald Remy, the counsel for the NCAA, was right on target. He used student-athlete, I think, 6 times in 3 sentences. So he's saying what he needs to say.
Jeff, I sort of look at this effort by these players at Northwestern and the greater body of players represented here, that it's kind of like shoot for Jupiter in hopes that you'll get to the moon, which is where they want to get in the first place. I mean, $5.15 billion going to be generated by the top 5 power conferences. And to Richard's point, scholarships don't cover the full cost of attendance. And again, I think most people in the public don't realize that. They think these guys are getting a free ride. They get a free education. What's the beef?
No, I think that's exactly right. And this brings up one distinction that we should be take notice of is when we talk about whether they can, quote, successfully unionize, what we mean is whether the law will require the universities to bargain with any union that select it. But there's, even if that's not successful, there is nothing stopping players from gathering together, even they can call it a union, and fighting and arguing for better work conditions. And at the minimum, that's what these players are doing right now. I mean, even in a state like North Carolina, where there is public sector collective bargaining isn't allowed, right? There's nothing stopping UNC players, if they chose, to, you know, gather together, make arguments, push, pull, whatever they need to do, within reason, of course, to try to improve their work conditions. And I think that's exactly what these Northwestern players are doing. And the fact that we and a whole lot of other people are talking about it shows that there's some success, at least at first.
Richard, why are we seeing this right now? And it's not just this. It's the O'Bannon case. It's other legislation that's pending that would give cover players for injury, cost of medical treatment beyond the time that they're at the university. There's so much stuff, it seems, to be coming to a head right now.
Well, I think it's a confluence of a number of issues. I think the filing of the O'Bannon case, which initially, if you go back to media reports and how that case was initially covered, it would be dismissed out of hand. I mean, oh, it'll never go to there. And then what's happened is each milestone has been met, and now the case is on course for trial in June. And so I think that's the first thing, is that the NCAA was not able, as most often they do, to settle this case. In the MIBA case, they bought the NIT tournament. You know, the cases that Andy Oliver's case, they settled. So I think it's that, it's social media. The players know each other much more than they have in the past. In basketball and football, they've gone growing up, gone to camps. They know each other. So I think that's a big part of it. And they're more savvy today as well.
Sports Focus will come back right after this.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show on 97.9 FM WCHL.
And welcome back to Sports Focus and our discussion of college athletes forming unions. Dr. Richard Southall and Jeff Hirsch from the UNC School of Law. Gentlemen, I want to pick up on a couple of things that we were talking about just before the break. The idea that these athletes at Northwestern specifically are getting support from their coach. They're even getting some support from administrators, saying this is perhaps not the avenue to go down, but these are things we need to talk about. Jeff, your response.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that makes this case a little bit unique. Oftentimes when you have a union drive, it's because employees are mad at their direct employer. And here it's almost the opposite, that there seems to be no dissatisfaction with Northwestern in particular. The problem is the NCAA, of course. And so this is a way of getting after them. And, you know, as Richard was saying earlier, I really think that's the sort of perception that the NCAA has got a lot of problems and isn't doing enough to address them is part of what's motivating these players, who also have, I think, more means and more willingness to do so. And I think this is one part of, again, a broader thing that we're going to keep seeing more of.
Richard, something that I want to come back to, even if the possibility of these players being able to unionize is a long shot, there is the question as to whether what they do, and this is in comparison to, say, grad assistants who teach, is what they're doing, these players participating in these sports, is it furtherance of the economic interests of the universities, or is it furtherance of their studies? That would be a key question in all of this, correct?
Well, I think one of the issues that's in play here, as well as in the O'Bannon case, is whether intercollegiate athletics, college sport, in the revenue-producing sports, whether it's an educational enterprise. Now, the NCAA has defined this as the collegiate model of athletics, and they say that amateur defines the participants, not the enterprise. That's Miles Brand's words. So if that's the case, if college broadcasts, which is where they generate a great deal of their money from, are educational, you would think that they would have a great deal of educational content. But what work that we've done over the last 7 years in analyzing college sport broadcasts find that on average there's sometimes less than 0.02% of educational messaging within a college sport broadcast. So basically 99% of everything that's going on is either directly related to the athletic game or its commercial content. Bugs and snipes and overlays and commentary and AT&T this and Geico this or whatever it is. And so, in fact, I think that's an interesting question related to graduate students as opposed to college profit athletes. Are they actually the same? Are college athletes students in the same way that grad students are? Because if the product is not educational but athletic, is that a distinction without a difference?
And Jeff, one particular Northwestern professor spoke about this, saying the university has significant control over the athletes and is able to tell them when to practice and what uniforms to wear, but they are students first. That, to me, is the key question. Are they students first when they spend 40 hours a week at their athletic pursuit?
Yeah, no, and obviously the time differential is an important one, and that can vary among the sports. Although I would say that even as a legal matter, that question about whether they're students or employees first is a bit controversial. In the graduate student case I mentioned earlier in the show, within the NLRB, the dissent, which were the Democratic board members, strongly argued against even considering this sort of balance, basically concluding that, look, they can be both student in some situations and employees in other situations. It's not an all-or-nothing proposition. And so there's an argument that's certainly plausible that, look, when they're doing athletics, practice, games, they're employees. When they're in class, they're students, right? You don't have to people moonlight. People have, you know, they're not employees 24/7. And there's no reason why you have to treat athletes, collegiate athletes, in that way either.
Richard, in the few seconds that we have left, this distinction of profit athletes and loss athletes, is that the distinction that must be made for all of this to make sense to the average sports fan?
I think it helps with this distinction because really what we're talking about here and why this is really happening more and more and more is the revenue that's being generated. When Woody Hayes at The Ohio State University made $30,000 and a professor there was making $35,000, you know, full professor, it didn't seem to bother anybody. But today, when you talk about billions and billions of dollars, I think something has to change.
And that does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guests, Richard Southall and Jeff Hirsch. Thanks also to producer Justin Blankenship and engineer Gary Kirk. Thanks to you for listening. Cheers.